Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, the state of the coronavirus in five Pennsylvania counties. But up front, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation and others are suing the Federal Environmental Protection Agency for not requiring Pennsylvania and New York to meet its agreed-upon Bay Cleanup 2025 goals. Specifically, the foundation says Pennsylvania is not meeting its nitrogen reduction commitments, and the state's plan is underfunded by $300 million. To tell us more about the suit and what Pennsylvania is not doing is Chesapeake Bay Foundation President Will Baker. Will Baker, welcome to the program.
Scott, good to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Mr. Baker, why bring the suit against EPA?
Well, Scott, Pennsylvania citizens are really the victims in this. Pennsylvania itself has designated 25,000 miles of polluted streams in the Commonwealth, and that number has been going up. The current EPA has rolled back innumerable environmental protection regulations, those that control coal-burning power plants in the Midwest, for instance. Air pollution is polluting Pennsylvania's rivers and streams, and that, of course, pollutes the bay downstream. And, you know, with regard to Pennsylvania's own commitment, the Environmental Protection Agency and Pennsylvania have violated a multi-year promise to try to clean up the rivers and streams of Pennsylvania. But I really think Pennsylvania is the victim here. EPA has simply turned back the clock maybe 30, 40, 50 years on clean air and clean water.
So when you are targeting EPA, I mean, one of the things we're going to talk about is what Pennsylvania is not doing right now to meet those bay cleanup goals. But you're targeting EPA. What should EPA have done specifically when it comes to the bay cleanup goals, Pennsylvania and New York?
Right. So I met with Administrator of EPA, Andrew Wheeler, about 2 years ago. And I urged him, with my board chairman, by the way, to help work with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation and many, many others who want to help try to accumulate federal funds that are already allocated. So redistribute federal funds to help Pennsylvania farmers reduce pollution, which really means keeping the soil and the chemicals on their land. It's beneficial to the farmer. The Federal Farm Bill, which is a federal bill, has more than enough money. It really would not even show up on their books with existing conservation funds, much of which goes to large industrial scale farms in the Midwest and far west. Let's put that money, some of that money, a small amount of that money, to work in Pennsylvania to save a great national treasure. The Chesapeake Bay, which includes very much a part of the Pennsylvania's network of rivers and streams. And he just looked at us like we were crazy. He basically just replied with happy talk. He implied that it was fake news, that there was a pollution problem, and everything was just fine.
I think that you've just answered this question, but I'll ask the question anyway. The Trump administration has attempted to defund the federal portion of the bay cleanup every year. Now, Congress has not gone along with that. Are you saying that EPA isn't even interested in making sure that the bay is cleaned up and that states comply in the cleanup?
Yeah, exactly. And there are a number of things that show that. Last December, the Bay Program's fella, the EPA's fella on the Bay Program, said, oh, no, this promise that was started with all of the states in the watershed and a number of federal agencies under the Obama administration was not enforceable. It was simply an aspiration. Wouldn't it be nice? But they said they completely reversed the prior 8 years of commitment to work together to get this job done. And, you know, it's not surprising. Andy Wheeler is a coal company lobbyist, a former coal company lobbyist. So that he's rolling back regulations right and left, not just cutting money, but rolling back regulations that absolutely reduce pollution. And, you know, when you think about coal-burning power plants in the Midwest polluting Pennsylvania's rivers and streams, I mean, that's just wrong.
So what do you want from the suit? I mean, the suit is saying that EPA did not require Pennsylvania and New York to meet its goals. But what specifically are you asking for?
Right. So first of all, we would like EPA to come back to the partnership table and to be the self-described referee. They were the ones who said, we will be the lead federal partner. And as the only jurisdiction of government which oversees the entire six-state, 64,000-square-mile Bay watershed, we are the only jurisdiction that can enforce the rules that everybody has agreed to. Pennsylvania and all the other states each agreed to reduce a certain amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment. So we want them to come back to the table, which they haven't done since this administration has been in office, come back as they were before and work with the states and do the job they said they would be, to referee, to be the arbiter. And certainly we think that they ought not to be involved with cutting the program to zero every year in terms of funding, but they ought to go way beyond that. They ought to work with their other federal partners to bring literally hundreds of millions of dollars into the watershed, and specifically to Pennsylvania. You know, reducing pollution from agriculture is the least expensive pound reduced. And farmers are lining up to be part of a cost-share program. They want to do the right thing, but they simply haven't been met halfway.
And basically what you're saying is that there are a lot of farmers that just can't afford to make the changes they need to make. Am I being accurate with that?
No, you know, you're absolutely accurate. Farmers absolutely want to do it. They're willing to invest their own money. But just like every other industry since environmental protection began many, many years ago, the government, federal and state, provides cost share monies to industries to help do the job. And in this case, the farmers just they're really the victims, is the way I look at it.
A few minutes ago, you said that it would take a small amount of money from the federal government to help Pennsylvania farmers. What do you call a small amount of money?
Yeah, I think we're all getting a little jaundiced in terms of what's big and what's small when it comes to money, when we hear about the billions and trillions. What do we have, a $3 trillion deficit in this country now? But no, it's a large amount of money. But the federal farm bill has much, much, much more money than Pennsylvania could ever absorb. But I thought what I had said was a small percentage of federal farm bill money could take care of Pennsylvania's hundreds of millions of dollars of agricultural cost share needs. So small relatively to the federal budget and to the federal farm bill budget. But sure, it's a large amount of money.
Well, how large? What kind of money are we talking about?
Well, Pennsylvania says that it's $300 million short annually on the plan that it has. Each of the states are required to produce incremental plans to meet their promises, which started back in 2010. And Pennsylvania says it's about $300 million annually short of what it needs. Unfortunately, Pennsylvania's plan only gets 75% of the way there. So the plan needs to be improved. And funding needs to come from somewhere. Senator Yaw, who we're so grateful for, he's been a real champion of the Bay and of reducing pollution to Pennsylvania streams. He will be introducing legislation that will provide some of the Pennsylvania share. But again, what we want to see is leadership from the federal government. This is a national treasure. It has been heralded all the way back to President Reagan as something that must happen. I've been running the Chesapeake Bay Foundation for almost 40 years, and I've seen time and time and time again the promises to clean up, to save a national treasure, go unmet. And that's just what we're experiencing now.
Well, okay, so Will Baker, you have been involved with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation for 40 years. Over the last 3.5 years, the Trump administration has tried to zero out the federal portion of the Bay cleanup. And as you said earlier, you don't think that EPA is interested in the Bay cleanup for the most part. So what would make them change now? What would bring them back to the table, as you say, and have them change here 3.5 years into this administration?
Well, see, that's the tragedy of it all, that an organization like ours, a not-for-profit organization, is having to try the last resort, and that's to go to the federal court system. Because as we allege in our filing, and as Maryland, Virginia, Delaware, the District of Columbia, the Maryland Watermen's Association, and others allege, EPA is violating the Federal Clean Water Act by turning its back. It's simply a matter of complying with the Federal Clean Water Act. And when you think about it, I mean, this is a national treasure. Well, I'm repeating myself. I think everybody agrees, but I just want your listeners to know how important it is for the water quality in the Commonwealth's own rivers and streams as well. It's all part of one system. That's what science tells us.
Do Pennsylvanians realize that? I mean, I know I'm asking a broad question there, but when we refer to this as the Chesapeake Bay cleanup, it focuses on the endpoint, the Chesapeake Bay. Do Pennsylvanians, you think, realize that we're talking about the small streams, the rivers, the creeks that run into, that are part of the Chesapeake Bay watershed?
When I came to the Chesapeake Bay Foundation in 1976 as an intern, one of the big challenges was having Maryland and Virginia work together and not fight over the resources of the Bay and how to improve them. But since the early 80s, science has been very clear, and Pennsylvania has been a very willing partner with all the other six states, New York, West Virginia, and Delaware, or the others besides Maryland, Virginia, with absolute clarity that it's a single system. There's just no debate, and that's been for 40 years.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News. And all things regional, I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll be talking about payroll deduction and Social Security. This is one of the ways that President Trump wanted to try to help grow the economy, was to get rid of the payroll deduction. Now, it's temporary for now, but the president has said if he's reelected that it could be permanent. But there are those who say that this will harm Social Security. We'll be talking about that on tomorrow's program. Today's program, we're talking about the Chesapeake Bay cleanup. Our guest is Chesapeake Bay Foundation President William Baker. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation and others, Will Baker just listed a number of them, plaintiffs a few minutes ago, has gone to court against the Federal Environmental Protection Agency to get Pennsylvania and New York to meet its Bay cleanup goals. If you have a question or comment you'd like to weigh in, our phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org if you'd like to leave a question or a comment on Twitter. You can do that by going to smarttalk@smarttalkwitf. 1-800-729-7532. Will Baker, these goals that we're talking about are for 2025, 5 years away. How do we know Pennsylvania will not meet those goals?
Well, by admission of the Pennsylvania's plan, their own plan, your own plan, falls short by about 25%. So that's not our analysis. That's Pennsylvania's analysis. But it's you're right to mention 5 years is a short amount of time or a long amount of time, depending on your perspective. We do still have time to get this done. We have time not to pull defeat. It's just, what's the old expression? Snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Let's snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. Two things you mentioned, though. We're not so much suing EPA to force Pennsylvania into compliance, although that's part of it. What we really would like Pennsylvanians to think of and EPA to think of is we're suing EPA to help Pennsylvania come into compliance. EPA could do an enormous amount with its federal partners. And you were talking earlier about, do Pennsylvanians realize that they are part of a single system called the Chesapeake Bay Watershed? Well, you need go no further than your great Penn State University, which has been a fabulous ally in describing how this all fits together in terms of a multi-state 64,000 square mile watershed, a national treasure. And it's all about helping Pennsylvania farmers do what they want to do, keep their soil and their chemicals on their farm, keep their animals healthy. It's about economic development in Pennsylvania for agriculture and a lot of other things. Think of tourism. Think of the fishing industry, the sport fishing industry. So there's a lot of benefit here, and it's just tragic. It's absolutely tragic that this administration has turned its back on what had been so successful for so long.
Let's take a call from Mike in York. Mike, you're on the air.
Both of you, as a longtime resident of Baltimore, of course, Chesapeake Bay, I'm very glad to hear this topic on the radio. I guess a couple questions. One is, when you mentioned that Chesapeake Bay is a treasure, Mr. Baker, you mentioned the incentives possibly for Pennsylvania farmers, but how else would you maybe describe it as a treasure in tangible ways for people to understand? And then my second part of the question is, what happens if Trump is reelected? What possible planning would you have for that?
Well, thanks, Mike. H.L. Mencken called it an immense protein factory. And Pennsylvanians, I know, realize that in some respects, because as you drive around the Commonwealth, you see some signs that say cold beer, hot crabs. Pennsylvanians love their blue crabs. They love their oysters coming out of the Chesapeake. And they love all the great sport fishing opportunities in Pennsylvania, which is such a part of the overall system. You know, shad used to run all the way up to Binghamton from the ocean through the Chesapeake proper up the Susquehanna. So it's historically, this has been one system, and we just have to keep reminding ourselves of that. The other question had something to do with something I think I'm not supposed to comment on about a not-for-profit 501c3 organization.
But I think if I could speak for you, I mean, obviously, unless EPA turns and does come, you know, changes its mind and comes to the table, you'll be looking at much the same thing, wouldn't you?
That's why we are going to the courts, to the federal court system, to really be the final arbiter. And we think because of case law, past case law, and the fact that when the American Farm Bureau Federation sued the prior EPA saying that this whole construct was illegal, the entire federal court system said, no, it's absolutely legal. And when they appealed to the Supreme Court said, no, we're not taking the case, which I'm stretching a little bit, but in effect, I think that said, no, it's legal.
You know, we've talked about this many times as to what Pennsylvania has to do, and you've talked about it a little bit, Will. But with the farmers, I think it's a good idea to remind people of or provide some context mm-hmm. of what Pennsylvania farmers in particular must do better to help meet these goals.
Right. And so it, the way I think about these things is give a farmer, because that's what we're talking about now. You could say it with a company or with an individual. Give them the objective and let them figure out how to do it best. So the objective is keeping the soil and the chemicals on the land. And there are many, many ways to achieve that, from conservation tillage to putting some buffers between the land and the water course. The other thing is keeping their livestock out of the streams. So fencing the streams, and there are and should be more cost share monies available to do this, it's also very good for the livestock. The large animal vets say that udder infections, hoof disease, many mastitis, et cetera, all go down when the cattle aren't wallowing in their own waste in the stream and, of course, damaging the stream. So there's another opportunity for win-win. Milk production goes up, but they need help. They need financial help to fence the cattle out of the streams and to put on conservation practices for tillage that reduce the amount of loss of chemicals and soil.
Let's take another call from Jake in Lancaster. Jake, you're on the air.
I just learned this weekend while renewing a vehicle registration, I learned about the KTRA, and I was wondering if we could hear a little bit more about that and how that's helping to close the funding gap.
All right, what is that? Will, what is that that he's referring to?
Jake, I think you said KTRA, and I know some things, not a lot, but that's one thing I don't know.
Jake, are you still there?
It was a Keystone Tree Restricted Account, a fund that's set up to help with this initiative.
Yes, I got it. Yeah, this is funding to help plant trees. Trees have so many benefits, from improving air pollution to holding soil on the land, to taking up nitrogen and phosphorus from the soil. So yeah, very, very important. We'd like to see it much expanded. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation is bringing private money into Pennsylvania to help plant trees. We actually have a goal of 10 million new trees in Pennsylvania by 2025. And among other partners, the Pennsylvania Farm Bureau. So from going from being on the opposite sides to being on the same side, that's the kind of thing that puts a smile on my face.
You know, Will, this question may seem out of left field, but there has been a lot of attention. I saw probably three stories this weekend in newspapers about the spotted lanternfly. Invasive species like that spotted lanternfly, when the Chesapeake Bay Foundation is trying to plant 10 million trees, and you're fighting an invasive species, not you necessarily, but we're fighting an invasive species that kills trees. I mean, these things are all kind of related, aren't they?
They really are. And you could also extend that to the intensity of storms. And this all falls under the rubric of climate change. So species, the change of species distribution in this world have been greatly affected by climate change. You know, we need look no further than Louisiana, the West, and the kind of storms and flooding that Pennsylvania suffered from in the last 24 months. This is another thing where this administration not only turns back regulations, they deny the very existence of climate change. It's just beyond belief.
So a couple things here. Pennsylvania is on track, admittedly, to meet 75% of its pollution diet. You mentioned that Senator Gene Yaw is planning to introduce some legislation, $300 million short of what would be needed here in Pennsylvania. Now, I know that during our conversation, you've talked about the EPA helping with that financial commitment. But if that doesn't happen, the $300 million that Pennsylvania is short, I mean, right now, Pennsylvania is looking at a $5 billion budget deficit because of the pandemic. Doesn't seem to be that it would be able to come up with $300 million when there's a $5 million or billion-dollar budget deficit. What do you think?
Well, I can't comment on why Pennsylvania legislators don't balance the budget. I have some opinions. The oil and gas industry, for instance, seems like it should be paying more of its fair share for the kind of impacts they've had in Pennsylvania, some positive, many negative. But that's really not my prerogative to say where or how. We want Gene Yaw's legislation to pass. We've worked closely with him. We think he's a champion. But really, this is where EPA needs to come in and say, as part of a national challenge, which started with President Reagan to save the Chesapeake Bay, we're going to work with our federal partners, especially the USDA, which has hundreds of billions of dollars available over the years to support farmers in Pennsylvania. Let's get one thing that we know how to do, and the science is absolutely clear. Take it from Penn State. What needs to be done? Let's take one part of this country that we've had a multi-decade commitment to and finish the job. We're that close. We can do this if we get the right kind of cooperation out of the federal government.
Will, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation puts out report cards from time to time on the health of the bay. But just so everyone knows, how would you describe the health of the bay today? From what I understand, it is much better than when this started. But how would you describe the health of the bay?
I might not say much better, but I certainly would say better. We snuck up from a basically an F 50 years ago, to a C-. We were so thrilled that our biannual report card got to a C-. And then all of those rains came 2 years ago, and they really drove the report back down to a D+. We'll be issuing the report again this December, so we haven't done one for 2 years. We're looking at all the metrics, and we'll see where the number is when it comes out.
Chesapeake Bay Foundation President Will Baker. Will, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, I really appreciate your attention to this for many, many years. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I want to let you know that the election season is starting a little bit early on the Smart Talk of this year. You know, every 2 years or so, we interview candidates for the U.S. House of Representatives, U.S. Senate, the statewide offices. Well, this year we're starting a little bit early because so many people will be mailing in ballots. Starting next week, next Monday, in fact, we'll have our first candidate on. And there are more than two dozen candidates that we have invited to appear on the program, and that includes candidates that are not affiliated with the Democratic or the Republican Party. So that's starting next Monday on Smart Talk. Even though we all have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, every county, city, and town have had their own unique challenges over the last 6 months. Penn Live is profiling five counties in a series called The State of the Coronavirus. And joining us today is reporter Wallace McKelvey. Wallace, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Happy to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, our phone number is 1-800-729-7532. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. The phone number, once again, 1-800-729-7532. So five counties being profiled in how they were hit by the coronavirus, how they've responded. What was the idea behind this series, Wallace?
Well, this all started probably a couple months ago when I was looking at the curves across the state by county, and what I noticed was how much diversity there was in the response and the actual effect of coronavirus from one county to the next, which naturally bled into another question, why? You know, what led to these disparate outcomes from one county to another? And we actually have the resources. You know, we have footprints in Pittsburgh, in Philadelphia. And I personally, I just knew there were some interesting stories out there worth covering. And that's what led us to actually visiting these places, talking to locals, and figuring out kind of what the stories were behind these curves, which everyone knows, you know, the goal is to bend the curve. Well, what actually goes into that?
Well, generally, though, and it's hard to paint with that broad brush, but your first premise of why there was the different impacts, some areas hit harder and responding, what did you find?
Yeah, well, we looked to begin with at five different places, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Lancaster County, Luzerne County, and Lebanon County. And it is difficult to point to any one thing as a causation, but what there are a couple things. One element is proximity to another outbreak. One very kind of major example of this is the disparity between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. Philadelphia, was very close to major outbreaks in New York and New Jersey, and there's a lot of interchange between those places. So it makes sense that they saw the first major outbreak in Pennsylvania, and they were also preparing for that on some level back in February, before much of the rest of the state was even beginning that process. And then out in Pittsburgh, they were somewhat delayed. They even though they had a stay-at-home order roughly around the same time that Philadelphia did, they did not see a major outbreak, like a really big one. Their spike didn't come until July 4th weekend.
You know, something else that I noticed with the five counties that you did profile is that, and I don't know whether it's accurate to say that they all handled it well. It took some time, and there have been a couple thousand people who have died since. But at this point, 6 months after the pandemic started, the five places that you profiled, they've seemed to have adapted, and the cases are going down. Is that an accurate way to describe this?
Perhaps not.
Really?
I think that the best way to look at this is right now we're in a lull, at least in the Northeast. You look at where the big outbreaks are right now, they're happening in the Midwest and the Dakotas. But as we see, with the progression of this pandemic, it comes in waves, and it's very likely that we'll see another wave, possibly fueled by the reopening of schools and the return of the fall season where more people are in confined spaces together. It's very possible we'll see another outbreak in the coming months, which is another reason for the timing of this series, is to kind of get a baseline of where things are right now. If you want to look at actual, progress on the ground, one area that I think is a running theme through a lot of these articles is this. The racial and economic disparities tend to be the biggest determinants for, who is hit the hardest. That is not that surprising. But if you look at Philadelphia, if you look at Luzerne, if you look at Pittsburgh, those are major themes to the struggles that local health officials had in those places. In Pittsburgh in particular, I spoke to an epidemiologist who was really trying to get the local officials to even just publish data on the impact of COVID-19 on these black communities, specifically in the African-American community there, which has a long history of segregation and discrimination. One of the kind of more telling things is I spoke to some people at Market Square in Pittsburgh, if people are familiar. It's kind of the main shopping restaurant area. And for a lot of the people there, life just seems fairly normal. One of the busboys I spoke to said he didn't know anyone who was sick. But then when I went up into one of these, you know, lower income, you know, mostly minority neighborhoods, I spoke to several people, one of whom I quoted in the story, who were able to rattle off, you know, 10, 15, 20 people they knew personally who were infected, some of them hospitalized, and some of them died from COVID-19, which underlines this racial disparity. You also see that to some extent in Philadelphia, where even in the best of times, it's difficult in some low-income neighborhoods to get access to food. I'm sure you've talked about food deserts before, this concept
right. mm-hmm.
that it's difficult to get healthy, nutritious food in some neighborhoods where maybe the only source is the food bank and the bodega down the street. And then you also have limited access to health care. And so in the best of times, that makes it challenging to deal with just a wide variety of health issues. And then you compound that with a global pandemic where a lot of people are out of work and just some factors within these communities, which I can talk more about if you like, to disparate health outcomes.
Well, let me go back to what you were talking about in Pittsburgh, for example. You said that the epidemiologist wanted the city or the county to require demographic information, racial information, ethnic information. Isn't that partly on the state? Because at first, especially when I say at first, first month or so, the state wasn't requiring that kind of data to be collected.
Yeah, and I've reported on that. The way the system works is there's also multiple pools of data. Like it very often at a local level, especially in the cities, they sometimes were recording it, but then not sending it to the state because the state wasn't requiring it. So you do have some access to that retroactively, but of course, in the middle of a pandemic, you know, the health officials, they're just scrambling to do the initial response. They're not necessarily thinking about, who is being disproportionately affected by this disease. And this is a common thread that we see, you know, we see it in Philadelphia, we see it in Pittsburgh, and we saw it statewide with the data being propagated by the Department of Health.
You mentioned Philadelphia and you mentioned poverty. In your story about Philadelphia, you say that poverty was probably the biggest issue in, you know, who contracted the virus, the health outcomes, that kind of thing. You've touched on this a little bit, but talk about Philly in particular, because the story actually says that compared to some other big cities, Philadelphia handled it pretty well because they did get an early start. Jefferson Health System started in February preparing for this before the whole country knew. And also, Philadelphia had a stay-at-home order that was a little bit earlier than even the states.
Yeah, and I should say that story, because this project was so large, it encompassed several different reporters. In Philadelphia, Julia Hatmaker wrote that story, although I had a hand in kind of shaping it and giving input after the fact. But yeah, you're right. You know, Philadelphia, because it had the resources and was already dealing with some of these issues, it had some of that stuff to call upon. You know, one example that I found particularly interesting is, you know, that Philadelphia actually opened a field hospital in mid-April in the anticipation of having to triage, of having to have like waves and waves and waves of patients come in. That field hospital, which cost $5 million to set up, ended up only treating 14 patients, and it was eventually shut down because the demand wasn't quite there for like the immediate health response. Now, all of that equipment is still sitting in storage in anticipation of another wave of transmission in the fall, which may or may not reach that level where they need it. But also, if you talk to people on the ground in Philadelphia, you know, the health disparities are real. I don't have the data right in front of me, but you can find it pretty easily in the minority zip codes and in the lower income zip codes. You actually do see higher rates of transmission. And I know from Pittsburgh, which I have a more intimate knowledge of, having written the story, that is very much the case. You are looking at a disease where, you know, that I'm sure you've heard this cliche before, you know, when the white folks catch a cold, black folks catch the flu. And I'm paraphrasing someone who actually said that to me. On the ground, you know, talking about these disparities. And, you know, another interesting part of this is looking at Hazleton and Luzerne County, which was written by Charlie Thompson. You know, he actually went back there because he reported on it when it was in the throes of a major outbreak. And the factors there intersect with along kind of racial and economic lines as well, predominantly around the Latino community. So the biggest employers there are the meat packing plants and the warehouses. And in those places, you know, because workers are in such close proximity, and some of them had challenges, at least initially, getting PPE, those places tended to fuel some of the early outbreaks, and a lot of them happened to be in Luzerne County. Also, a lot of them tended to employ lower-income workers, and specifically Latino workers in the Hazleton area, who didn't have the option to stay home from work. They didn't have the option to work from home, which also intersects with these economic issues. In Hazleton, you know, a lot of these workers also commuted to work via carpool. So that means that they're sitting in a car for 15, 30 minutes together in close proximity, possibly not wearing masks, because you have to remember early on, we were told not to wear masks. And then some of them were hired through temporary staffing agencies, which are very difficult to contact trace. And they're also living, in some cases, in multifamily households, or sometimes in, you know, apartment buildings where you have people from different families living in the same room or the same apartment. All of that creates the environment for more transmission of COVID-19.
Wallace, you wrote the story about Lebanon County, and Lebanon County had a unique situation. The county commissioners, the Republican majority county commissioners, there was a resolution that they wanted the state to move from the red to the yellow sooner than the governor would allow it. Then they said they were going to go green, and there were some repercussions for Lebanon County. Talk about Lebanon County. Some said that this was pure politics of Governor Wolf, keeping Lebanon County from going green when the other 66 counties did, that it was pure politics. The governor's office says, no, that's not the case. What did you find?
Yeah, and Lebanon County is predominantly a political story, because if you look at the actual transmission rates, you know, Lebanon County was not too far off the mark compared to some of its neighbors. What's really fascinating here is that there were a number of counties. I counted seven in my reporting, but I very well may have missed a few, who at least, like, their county government made noise about, you know, moving from red to yellow before the governor did it. And you have to remember that the governor's, you know, administration has the authority to reopen. They took they have that authority. They set up the red, yellow, green system. So at least seven counties said, you know, hey, we think we should be reopening. We're thinking about just doing it. The difference is Lebanon County really went out on a limb, as one of the local business people told me, and they took a vote and they passed a resolution and they did it. What's interesting is that the county commissioners, and in talking to me, said, well, we thought we wouldn't be alone. You know, we thought other counties would join us in this. And then when they did it, suddenly they were out, literally out on that limb alone doing this thing. They also told me this is their justification, but that they consider this to be a symbolic gesture. And in reality, very few businesses actually opened because the county told them, because there were repercussions for it. You know, these businesses could lose their licenses if they were dinged by the governor's administration. And then kind of what happened was it set up this conflict over, you know, who has the authority to do this. And ultimately, Governor Tom Wolf withheld the federal relief aid CARES Act funding from Lebanon County for a period of several months, which then, like, kind of kicked into high gear a political and legal conflict between the locals and state government.
Hey, Wallace, we only have about 2 minutes, and I want to touch on Lancaster County, because Lancaster County was one of those seven counties that you mentioned that kind of fought back, but there was a difference with Lancaster County in that because of its population, it was getting money directly from the federal government, but also large Latino population, not to mention an Amish population as well. In 2 minutes or less, talk about Lancaster County, if you could.
Oh, sure. Well, Lancaster, the biggest thing is how diverse it is. You know, Lancaster City is an urban area just like any other, and so they dealt with similar issues as, you know, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, just at a much smaller scale, with a large Latino community, but also a large immigrant community, period. Like, they have many languages being spoken in Lancaster, because it is a hub for people being refugees, being resettled from all over the world. And then, of course, you have the rural community surrounding it, Amish people who, because of their faith, you know, their life and their tradition is built around large family and church gatherings. And so you have two very different vulnerable communities, and then a third, which is the large retirement communities and nursing homes in Lancaster County. And what that meant is that the local health authorities, you know, had to split their attention, whereas in some places you may only have a couple really distinct vulnerable areas. Lancaster County had a bunch of different vulnerabilities that it had to address at the same time. And if you look at the curve, their curve hasn't really gone down that much, but it also never reached a definitive peak either.
So the series is called The State of the Coronavirus on Penn Live and the Patriot News. It was in all five stories in yesterday's paper. But Wallace, how can our listeners read about the five communities and the series?
Well, right now, probably the best way is to look me up on Twitter, at WJ McKelvey, because I just recently tweeted out all five of the stories, and you can very easily just click from one to the other to the other. And also, just keep coming back to Penn Live, because we plan on continuing to possibly return to these communities and also expand to other counties around the state and take a look at how they responded and get updates as we progress through this pandemic.
Wallace McKelvey of Penn Live, Patriot News. Wallace, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll talk to you tomorrow morning.